Have you ever been like completely in the zone? You know that feeling.
Oh, absolutely.
You're deep into a complex workflow, your brain is just firing on all cylinders, the plan is finally coming together, and then bam,
You hit the wall.
you hit an artificial wall, everything just completely grinds to a halt. And today we are looking at exactly that scenario, but with a twist that is honestly going to completely change how you think about the tools you use every day.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating one.
We are diving into a situation where a developer kept hitting this 5-hour usage limit in Claude Code. And, well, they decided they were not going to just accept it. They engineered this brilliant, completely invisible solution to bypass the friction.
Right, and it's a fascinating look at system architecture
Right.
because, they didn't just build a simple script or like a quick little workaround.
Right.
They built an entire automated orchestration layer that operates completely in the shadows of the operating system.
Yeah, we have this developer log today, and it's titled, I Taught My Claude Accounts to Rotate Themselves.
Which is just a great title.
It really is. So the mission for this deep dive is to basically unpack this clever, entirely undocumented Mac OS trick that made the whole project possible.
Unpacking the plumbing, basically.
Exactly. We're going to look at the mechanical plumbing of how it actually works, the hilarious and agonizing bugs that came up during the build. And ultimately, we want to arrive at a really profound realization about the boundary between human intuition and AI-generated code.
Because knowing what to build is a vastly different skill from knowing how a system actually behaves in the messy real world.
So true. Okay, let's unpack this. We should probably start with the friction that actually kicked off this entire project.
Yeah, so anyone who is a heavy user of Claude Code is probably intimately familiar with this wall. You basically have a 5-hour usage window.
Right.
You're working away, building something, and quietly, that window just fills up. And when it hits the limit, you are locked out until the timer resets.
Which is brutal when you're in the middle of a thought.
Exactly. Now, if you happen to pay for more than one account, say you have like a personal Max account or a work Max account, the logical fix is to just switch to the other account.
But switching on macOS usually means logging out. You have to literally stop what you're doing, re-authenticate in a web browser, and then your running terminal session just loses its login state.
Yeah, you lose your place completely.
In whatever complex task you were right in the middle of, it is like the ultimate flow state killer.
It completely shatters the context.
Yeah.
So the developer's dream here was to create a seamless background rotation.
Right.
Think about how a smartphone operates when you leave your house. You're on a phone call, you walk out the front door, and the device just seamlessly hops from your home Wi-Fi network over to cellular data.
And you don't drop the call.
You don't drop the call, and you don't even notice a thing. That was the goal here. The active account should dynamically rotate itself to the next one that has headroom right before hitting that 5-hour wall while the developer just keeps typing.
No props.
No logouts, just continuous operation.
Which, I mean, that sounds like absolute magic. But the coolest part of this deep dive isn't just that they wanted this magic, it's the hidden mechanic they discovered that actually made it possible in the first place.
Right, because it all hinges on a really specific, completely undocumented fact about how Claude Code handles authentication on a Mac.
And they had to figure this out themselves, right?
Yeah, the developer had to verify this behavior entirely by hand because it's not written down in any official documentation anywhere.
Wow.
Generally, when you run an application and log in, that application fetches your authentication token once
Okay.
and it holds onto it in its active RAM, its memory, for the life of the process. It does this because reading from memory is incredibly fast.
Makes sense.
But Claude Code doesn't do that.
See, my first assumption would be that it just reads a local credentials file. Like there's a physical file on your hard drive, right? Like
Rare.
dot claude slash dot credentials dot json.
Yep, that file exists.
So I would think you could just open a text editor, swap the tokens in that JSON file, and boom, the app sees the new account.
But the developer found out that editing that JSON file does absolutely nothing to a live running session.
It just ignores it.
It is completely ignored by the active process. That file is essentially just a mirror for storage.
Okay, so what is actually happening mechanically?
What's happening is that Claude Code reads its token directly from the macOS keychain. Specifically, there's a single keychain item named Claude Code Credentials.
Oh, interesting.
And here is the critical design choice. It reads from that keychain item per request.
Wait, per request?
Every single time the application needs to make a call to the server API, it pauses, goes back to the macOS keychain, fetches the token, and then makes the request.
That's wild. It's like a bouncer at a club who doesn't just check your ID at the door when you walk in.
Right.
This bouncer follows you around the club and asks to see your ID every single time you order a drink.
That is a perfect way to put it.
Every time you try to go to the bathroom, every time you talk to someone, which sounds incredibly annoying in real life, but in software architecture, it creates a massive loophole.
Exactly.
Because if you can distract the bouncer for just 1 second and like hand a different ID to the person ordering the drink, the bouncer just looks at the new ID, says okay, and serves the drink.
That visualizes the loophole perfectly. Because of that aggressive per-request check against the keychain, the developer realized they had a primitive they could exploit here.
Right.
If you can dynamically rewrite that one specific item in the macOS keychain, you can just hot swap the account underneath a running session.
Without it even noticing.
Exactly. The active process goes to make its next request, pulls what it assumes is the exact same token from the keychain,
yeah,
and quietly authenticates as an entirely different account.
The session itself never knows it happened. No restart required. No re-login prompt.
None of that.
It honestly blows my mind that this is possible. Just swapping the rug out from under the app, and the app doesn't even care.
It's very clever.
But hang on. Knowing a theoretical trick is one thing. Giving a background script permission to just smash and rewrite your global system keychain without asking you, isn't that a massive security vulnerability?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I wouldn't want some rogue daemon silently tampering with my system credentials.
That is a very valid security concern, and the operating system actually prevents you from doing that easily. macOS binds an always allow grant on a keychain item to the calling application's specific code signature.
Okay, so what does that mean in practice?
It means if the developer built a custom tool to edit the keychain and then tweak the code and recompile that tool later, the code signature would change.
Oh, I see.
And the operating system would instantly block it and throw up a big security prompt, which obviously ruins the silent, invisible nature of the rotation.
So how do you rewrite the keychain silently without triggering macOS security alarms every 5 minutes?
By routing every single write operation through Apple's own stable built-in command line utility, specifically /usr/bin/security.
Oh, sneak.
By piping the commands through Apple's native binary, the permission grant is tied to a stable system component, not the developer's constantly changing custom tool.
So you authorize the terminal once, and the OS handles the security boundaries reliably from then on.
Exactly.
Clever. They found a safe way to pick the lock. So how do they actually build the machine to do it?
Well, this is where the developer brings in Claude Code itself as a co-pilot, which is delightfully meta.
It really is. They are using the AI to build a tool to hack the AI's own usage limits.
It's a brilliant example of recursive tool building. So the developer started by forking an existing terminal account switcher called Cloth.
Okay.
Then, using Claude Code to write a lot of the implementation, they added the keychain hot swap mechanism we just discussed. And next, they built the core engine, which is a headless Rust daemon.
A headless daemon. Just the phrase makes it sound like something lurking in the shadows.
It does sound a bit ominous.
For anyone listening who might be unfamiliar, that essentially means a background program with absolutely no user interface, running silently. Why choose Rust for something like this?
Rust is incredibly memory efficient, and it excels at concurrency, which is managing multiple tasks at the exact same time without crashing.
Right.
This daemon's job is to sit in the background and constantly poll the server for the usage metrics of every single account you own.
So it's always watching.
Always watching. When it detects that the currently active account has crossed 95% of its 5-hour window, the daemon automatically executes an ordered fallback chain.
Oh.
It scans for the next account in your list that has available headroom, triggers that usr bin security command, and rewrites the keychain.
So you could literally have your terminal closed, go out to lunch, and come back to find you are 3 accounts down the chain, completely ready to work.
Yep, completely invisible to you.
But I mean, a headless daemon running in the shadows is terrifying.
Can be, yeah.
You need to know what it is doing, or you are flying completely blind. So they couldn't just stop at the daemon. They had to build a user interface, right?
They did. They built something called CC's Bar, which stands for Claude Code Switcher Bar. It's a native Swift UI menu bar app that just sits at the top of your Mac screen.
Okay.
The Rust daemon publishes a tiny status.json file every second, and the menu bar app simply reads that file to display your current usage bars.
Which is standard enough, but the UI doesn't just say, here is your current usage.
No, it goes further.
Right, it actually tells you what the daemon is going to do next in the future. It says things like, watching work would switch to personal at 95%.
Yes.
I have to ask, how do you trust that prediction? If you have a background daemon written in Rust and a menu bar UI written in Swift, aren't those two completely separate brains?
They are.
So how do you prevent the UI from lying to you about what the daemon is actually going to do?
That brings us to one of the most elegant technical choices in the whole project, the use of a pure function.
A pure function?
Yeah. In computer science, a pure function is a concept where the output is determined 100% by the inputs, with zero observable side effects.
Meaning what, exactly?
It doesn't check the system clock, it doesn't read a random number generator, it just does pure math.
Ah, okay.
The developer duplicated the exact chain walk logic of the Rust daemon and dropped it directly into the Swift UI app as a pure function.
So they feed the exact same data to both brains.
Precisely. Because it is a pure function, it's mathematically guaranteed to reach the exact same conclusion as the daemon every single time.
Wow.
The UI's prediction can never drift from what the daemon will execute because they are running identical, isolated logic on the same exact status file.
That is incredibly clean.
It really is.
But wait, there is one more piece of plumbing here. If this background daemon is going to log into these accounts and fetch tokens, it has to authenticate.
Right.
And usually Claude logs you into a specific project folder. But the daemon is system-wide. How does a global daemon handle the login process?
That directory scoping was a major hurdle. Claude Code's default /login command on macOS writes the authentication token to a per directory keychain item.
So it's locked to whatever folder you're in.
Exactly. It's locked to the specific folder you are working in. A system-wide background daemon cannot see those directory-specific items.
So what did they do?
So the fork had to completely bypass the standard login and mint its own tokens globally using a PKCE flow.
PKCE. Break that down for me mechanically. How does that actually work?
So PKCE stands for Proof Key for Code Exchange.
Okay.
It's an OAuth security protocol designed specifically for public clients, like a desktop app that cannot safely store a secret backend password.
Because anyone could just open the app's files and find the password.
Exactly. Instead of having a static password, the PKCE flow dynamically generates a random cryptographic secret called the code verifier right on your machine.
Oh, interesting.
It mathematically hashes that secret and sends the hash to the server when it asks to log in.
So the server knows what the secret looks like when it's scrambled, but it doesn't know the actual secret.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Then your browser opens, you approve the login, and the server sends an authorization code back to your app.
Okay, I'm following.
To finally get the actual token, your app sends that authorization code back to the server along with the original unhashed secret. The server runs the math, verifies it matches the hash from earlier, and hands over the token.
That is so smart.
It proves that the application requesting the token is the exact same application that started the login process, which prevents a malicious app from intercepting the code.
And because they built this custom PKCE flow into their fork, the daemon can authenticate directly and write the tokens where it can actually access them globally.
Yep, the plumbing is brilliant.
It really is. But this brings us to the reality check. Building the plumbing, the Rust code, the pure functions in Swift, the PKCE OHAF flows, that was actually the easy part.
Oh, yeah.
Because as soon as they turned this thing on, they ran into the fundamental nightmare of system design.
A daemon's worst bug is a silent one.
Yes. When a system knows something that the user doesn't, you have a critical failure in observability.
Right. If an app on your screen crashes, it disappears. You know it broke.
But if a background daemon dies, your menu bar might just freeze. The usage numbers stop updating, but they still look like live, healthy numbers.
You might think you have plenty of time left, but you're actually hitting the wall.
Or worse, what if the daemon successfully auto-switches at 2 a.m. while you're asleep? You wake up, sit down with your coffee, start working, and you have absolutely no idea which account you are billing your API calls to.
That's a huge issue. So the developer realized they had to aggressively combat this silence.
How so?
The entire design philosophy of the menu bar app shifted from show the data to expose every possible state.
Okay.
Every silent state the daemon could possibly experience had to be given a loud, visible, fixed home in the UI.
Make it obvious.
Exactly. If the daemon dies, the menu bar doesn't just sit there looking normal. It turns all the numbers gray and literally stamps it with the text frozen 4 meters ago.
Oh, that's smart. It actively prevents dead data from impersonating live data.
Exactly.
That is a great safety net. And for the 2 a.m. auto rotations, they made it so the menu bar flashes the words rotated to personal for 8 straight seconds.
So if it happens while you're looking or you just sit down, you have undeniable visual proof that the hero feature actually fired.
But the most critical UI fix they implemented was for dropped logins. If a token expires or an account gets disconnected, the menu bar immediately displays a red badge and a one-click button that just says log in again.
Which sounds so simple, right? Just click the button and log back in.
Right.
But this is where the story gets incredibly painful. Shaming that little login again button exposed what the developer called a stacked bug.
This is the stuff of developer nightmares.
It really is.
Yeah.
A stacked bug is when multiple independent system failures perfectly align to hide each other.
Oh, man.
You fix one, only to reveal the next, like peeling an onion made of errors.
I hate those.
So the developer tested the dropped login detection using automated fixtures, basically simulated fake data, and all the tests passed with flying colors.
Naturally.
But the moment they ran it in reality, the running Claude session started failing, throwing an error saying, not logged in, please run /login.
But wait, the daemon was reporting that it was fine?
The daemon was cheerfully reporting that the account was perfectly healthy.
It was lying to them.
Completely lying.
And it turns out it was lying because of 3 distinct bugs stacked on top of each other. Let's walk through this agony because it's fascinating. Layer 1, the dead login, was returning a 429 error instead of a 401.
Right. So the daemon's usage poller was designed to refresh a token only when the API returned a 401 error.
Which means what?
401 is the standard HTTP status code for unauthorized.
Okay.
That is the correct, logical way to handle a dead token. But in reality, the API was returning a 429 status code for this specific dead account.
And 429 means...
429 means too many requests, which is a rate limit.
So the background poller sees a 429 and assumes, oh, the server is just really busy right now. I'll just wait and try again later. In the meantime, I'll just keep showing the user the last known good number.
Exactly. It treated the 429 as a temporary hiccup, falling back to cached data. A genuinely dead login was permanently hiding behind a rate limit code.
That is so frustrating.
The developer noted that the fix was obvious only in hindsight. If you get a 429 on a token that is also past its actual mathematical clock expiration time, that is not a rate limit.
No, it's a dead token wearing a rate limit costume.
Exactly.
It's like having a houseplant that has completely died. Right, it's dried up, turned brown, but someone sneakily spray painted the leaves green.
Right.
If you just glance at it from across the room, which is basically what the poller was doing, you assume it's fine. But if you actually touch the soil, if you check the expiration date, you realize it's completely dead. You have to investigate further to surface the truth.
That analogy hits the nail on the head. So they fix layer 1. They force the system to recognize the dead token and surface the red badge.
Okay, progress.
The user sees it, clicks that log in again button,
and
they hit layer 2.
The button didn't work.
The terminal command failed completely.
Because the command they were triggering was cloth login account name. And cloth was designed to create brand new accounts.
Exactly.
It wasn't built to re-authenticate an existing one. It just spit back an error saying, a profile named X already exists and refused to even open the browser. The button was completely broken.
It failed before the authentication process could even begin.
So what did they do?
The developer goes into the code, rewrites the logic to properly handle re-authentication, clicks the button, the browser opens, they log in. The new tokens are minted via that PKCE flow.
Okay, beautiful.
Everything succeeds. They check the local JSON file. And it is pristine. The new tokens are there. The system is healed.
Except layer 3 arrives.
Oh, yes. Layer 3.
Because they go back to their terminal, try to run a Claude prompt, and the live session is still broken. They updated the JSON file, but they forgot to write the new token to the keychain.
Which brings us all the way back to the start of this deep dive.
The original loophole.
The live session on macOS ignores the JSON file and reads exclusively from the keychain.
Wow.
The re-authentication technically succeeded, the files on disk were correct, but the live session kept reading the dead token from the one place the developer forgot to rewrite.
It all loops back to the bouncer. They got a brand new ID, they put it in their wallet, they felt great about it, but they forgot to actually hand the new ID to the bouncer.
Right.
So the bouncer just keeps looking at the old expired ID and denying entry.
To finally fix it, they had to force a keychain write whenever the currently active account is re-authenticated. They had to apply that initial primitive to the one edge case they missed.
Unbelievable.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, what is truly profound here is that automated tests missed absolutely all of this. The unit test said the system was flawless.
The code was mathematically correct, but the system behaved completely differently in reality.
Exactly.
And that leads us to the ultimate philosophical question of this whole deep dive. Because this developer built this entire tool with an AI co-pilot.
Right.
The AI was writing thousands of lines of Rust and Swift. So when you are building software with AI, where is the boundary? Who is responsible for what?
The developer arrived at a really elegant conclusion about the division of labor here. The AI was highly successful at writing complex code, you know, handling thread concurrency in Rust, building the pure forecast engine in Swift, mapping out the PKCE flow.
Sure, the heavy lifting.
Because that code had machine-checkable success criteria.
Yeah.
A unit test can easily verify if a chain walk algorithm matches the expected output. A test can verify if a socket command successfully completes a round trip.
It means the AI is incredible at the logic puzzles.
Yes.
But the actual boundary line, the place where the human becomes indispensable, isn't about whether the code is hard or easy. The line is drawn at what the developer calls truth it couldn't observe.
Reasoning alone does not solve system architecture. You have to run the experiment in the real world.
Right.
The entire foundation of this project, the fact that a running Claude code process on Mac OS rereads the keychain on every single request, is not something an AI could just deduce from reading code repositories.
Because it wasn't documented.
It wasn't in any documentation.
Mm-hmm.
The human had to physically change the keychain, switch back to the terminal, and watch the prompt to see what happened.
It is the messy physical reality of computing. The AI cannot physically click through a browser window to complete an OSIP sign-in and see what happens.
Well, no.
It can't intuitively know that a 429 error from this specific API actually means the token is dead, not just rate limited, because the API is technically lying.
Exactly.
Those are empirical facts that live outside the code, in a world the AI simply cannot perceive.
The AI drives machine-checkable definitions of done to completion. The human stays in the loop to verify the empirical truth. The human is the bridge to the running system.
Which is such a powerful way to frame it. It gives us a blueprint for how to actually work with these tools, rather than just expecting them to do everything by magic.
It really does.
Whether you are a programmer writing Rust daemons or just someone navigating an increasingly automated world, this story isn't just about a clever macOS hack to get past a 5-hour limit.
No, it's bigger than that.
It is a masterclass in collaboration based on observability. Let the machine do what it can measure, and you handle what you can observe.
Perfectly said.
And just to wrap up the narrative, the developer notes that the daemon is now working flawlessly. It is humming away invisibly, rotating accounts for days on end.
That's awesome.
The only time they even notice it is when they are mid-sentence deep in the zone and the menu bar quietly flashes rotated to personal and they just get to keep typing. They never hit the wall.
It is a remarkable achievement in engineering your own environment.
It really is.
But it does leave us with a very important question, one that builds on everything we have explored today.
What's that?
We have established here that humans are required for empirical, real-world truth, the physical realities and system behaviors that AI cannot currently observe or interact with.
Right.
But as AI systems gain more agency, as they are given the ability to browse the live web, to physically click buttons on a screen, to execute their own active experiments in live production environments, what happens to that boundary?
Oh, wow.
When AI starts defining and verifying its own empirical truths in the messy real world, what role is left for the human in the loop?
Are we just going to become the bouncer checking the IDs, or are we going to be the ones locked outside the club? That is something to mull over next time you hit a wall and wonder who or what is going to help you climb over it. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.